Chapter 40. How Not to Run a Public Library. Washington, D.C., 1975 to 1976. One day in early 1975, Susie Buffett's friend Eunice Denenberg came over to the house and sat on the dog hair covered sofa in the family room. Susie turned her back so she wouldn't have to face her friend and turned on the tape deck. Then she sang. Denenberg pronounced approval. They talked about Susie's dream of singing professionally, which she was too diffident to do anything about herself. Denenberg went home, then she called back the next day and said, "This is your agent." She enlisted Bob Edson, an assistant music professor at Midland College, to create a backup band and got Susie a gig at the Steam Shed, a nightclub in Irvington, the tiny town on Omaha's outskirts where she and Dottie had once formed the choir in her father's church. Susie was nervous, but the rest of the family was enthusiastic. Only Doc Thompson, who said, "I don't know why you want to sing in bars," had any doubts. The night of Susie's first public performance, before a crowd made up of about 35 friends, she was so anxious that she asked Warren not to come. Talking and greeting people in a long, sequined dress, she stalled until Denenberg pushed her out onto the stage. From Aretha Franklin's "Call Me" to Sinatra's "You Make Me Feel So Young" to Blood, Sweat, and Tears, "You've Made Me So Very Happy," to what she said was one of her favorites, Roberta Flack's "The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face," her choice of music was soulful, passionate, and romantic. Susie found that the audience responded to and returned her warmth. The same pulse and flow she got from connecting with people individually came through in a wave when she sang to a group in an intimate space. This was her special gift, transmuted and magnified. She wanted to become a cabaret singer. A few weeks later, however, Susie was pulled away from rehearsals for her next performance to go to Carmel, California, to help her sister-in-law Bertie, whose youngest daughter Sally was dying of a brain tumor. Bertie's marriage to Charlie Snorf was crumbling at the same time. When Sally died, Bertie discovered that the tragedy had unlocked her frozen emotions. Sally was a wonderful person, amazing and intuitive, and so strangely insightful about people and feelings for a 7-year-old, Bertie says. Once she told me, "Mom, you and Dad are lonely together. I think when someone dies who's very close to you, they will you something. When Sally died, what she willed to me was that I couldn't deny my feelings to myself anymore. It was like a copper wire went straight into my heart, and I couldn't cover up my feelings from then on." Bertie had always had a special relationship with Susie, but when her heart opened after Sally died, suddenly they connected on a different level. "Susie was somebody I loved who was so important to me," says Bertie. "She was the only person I could talk to about my feelings when there was nobody else in my family whom I could do that with." Her brother, however, reacted differently to his niece's death. He called some friends who had visited the Buffetts in Laguna and told them about Sally. "We were so shocked because we'd all been together a week or two before," says Mary Holland. "I asked him what happened, and he said, 'I can't talk anymore,' and got off the phone." Warren, at the time, had many distractions to assist him in evading his feelings. He was finishing up the SEC investigation. He was so fascinated with Kay Graham that he literally could not get enough of her. When Warren got obsessed with something, especially someone new, he could not stop thinking about it or them. This came across to a new person as a wholehearted, flattering, and even overwhelming attentiveness. When business arose, however, he snapped back to it in a split second with all the fierce intensity his steely mind could muster. As Munger put it, "Buffett never let his minor obsessions interfere with his major obsession." Catherine Graham, however, was no minor obsession. Sometime earlier, he had decided to see what sparks would fly when she brushed up against Munger, the greatest smartass he knew. Kay was the kind, if I gave topics of things for her to do, she was very dutiful. If I told her to read some terribly complicated financial statements, she was going to follow my instructions, no matter what. I told her, "You have to meet Charlie." I was laying it on thick. Finally, she was out in Los Angeles and went to meet Charlie. So she sat down in that scrubby office of Charlie's, and immediately she pulls out a yellow pad so she can take notes on what he's saying. Charlie just loved it. The idea that everything he was saying was so important that the most powerful woman in the world had to be taking it down as fast as he could talk. Munger could not resist this encouragement to show off. He had been corresponding with Graham and wrote to her, "You are taking me back 30 years or more and making me behave like Tom Sawyer with Becky Thatcher, and I figure that Warren is silly enough for both of us." But however giddily she might be making Warren behave, he was also taking Kay to business school in a serious way. Kay had had me trying to explain accounting to her on the side. I'd bring these annual reports to Washington, and she'd say, "Oh, Warren, lessons." There I was, teaching again. He considered her son Don unbelievably smart, with as close to a photographic memory as anyone I've ever run into. As a sign of reassurance to the family, Warren had signed the voting proxy on his shares over to Don. He now stayed at Kay's house when he came to Washington for monthly board meetings. She didn't approve of the way he dressed, but I told her, "I'll dress as well as Don dresses," Buffett says. He and I had a sort of united front. Buffett felt that Kay was very, very smart, and in many ways wise, as long as you didn't go into those areas where the wounds were. But she understood people well. As they grew more intimate, he felt he could say something to her about the way she presented herself to her board. He knew she was less needy than she herself realized. One day he took her aside and said, "You can't plead for help any more from the board. It's just not the position you want to be in." And so, he says, she quit. The business and personal ties between the Grahams and Buffett had become close enough that Warren invited Catherine and Don to join the Graham group at their 1975 meeting at Hilton Head. Don made an immediate impression with his unpretentious manner while raising its already high average IQ. Many people quickly saw beneath Kay's brittle patrician veneer to the vulnerability and humility that had endeared her to Warren. Thus, she fit easily with most of the group, despite her queenly presence, worldliness, and connections. She made a sincere effort to get along with everyone, although her deep belief that men were far superior to women wasn't lost on the women at the meeting. The beautifully dressed, perfectly coiffed Graham, an icon among them, would slide casually into a chair amid the men with a cocktail in her hand. Somebody would utter a political opinion, and she would respond, "Henry thinks thus and so." Speaking of Kissinger, it was impossible not to be impressed. Susie Buffett sang for the group for the first time at Hilton Head. Bill Ruane brought a chart showing the price of gold, which for 5 years had surged past Berkshire Hathaway's. He asked, the others thought jokingly, whether he should be buying metal. It would turn out that he had, in fact, been buying gold coins and made a nice bit of money on it. Henry Brandt pulled Buffett into a separate room and asked him to promise that Berkshire stock wouldn't drop below $40. By October 1975, the stock had been cut in half after trading at $93 just 2 years before. "Look, I love you," Buffett recalls saying, "but I can't promise you that." "The world is ending," said Brandt, or words to that effect. "I've got every dollar I own in this stock." The world continued to end. Even though the rest of the stock market was recovering, Berkshire was not. Brandt panicked and called Buffett, who offered him $40 a share. Then Brandt called Walter Schloss and said, "Warren will pay me $40 and I want $50. What should I do?" Schloss was the last champion of cigar butts. At the Graham Group meetings, the others razzed him about his buggy whip portfolio of bankrupt steel companies and destitute auto parts makers. "So what?" said Schloss. "I don't like stress, and I sleep well at night." He filled out the simple checklists, applying Graham's philosophy in its purest form. He went home from his desk in the closet at Tweedy Brown at 5 o'clock every evening, and his results were phenomenal. Now Schloss was dismayed to hear Brandt telling himself he was better off without Berkshire stock in a way that contravened this whole cigar butt philosophy. Schloss worked on him for 2 hours, saying, "You've got the smartest guy in the world managing your money, in effect, and Warren doesn't charge you anything. You're making a big mistake to sell. I thought I convinced him, says Schloss. But the U.S. economy by then was in so much trouble that New York City was almost bankrupt. The country was in a mood of such profound pessimism that it affected people's judgment. On Monday, he called his broker, says Schloss, and began selling his wife's shares, not his own, until half their shares were gone. Immediately afterward, President Ford refused a bailout of the New York City economy. The New York Daily News captured the feeling of the times in a huge headline, "Ford to City, Drop Dead." The partners who had been given Berkshire stock in 1970, when it was trading around $40, seemed no better off 5 years later. "To anybody who held our stock," says Munger, "it looked like not much was happening favorably for a long, long time. And that was not the way our partners, by and large, had previously experienced things. The paper record looked terrible, yet the future, what you might call the intrinsic record, the real business momentum, was gaining all the while." Buffett's own net worth, based on where the stock was trading, had likewise been sliced to the level of when he closed the partnership. Yet despite this apparent destruction of wealth, which would have frightened almost anyone else, his pulse never seemed to flutter. He just had the companies he controlled keep buying and buying and buying. In 1974, before the SEC investigation began, Berkshire owned 26% of Blue Chip. Although he put the brakes on at Berkshire during the 1975 Omni Aviation affair, through Diversified, he bought Berkshire stock. By 1976, he was buying both Berkshire and Blue Chip through Diversified. When all was said and done, Berkshire would own more than 41% of Blue Chip, so much that he and Susie owned, personally and through Berkshire Hathaway, 37% of the stock all by themselves. And as long as Berkshire was cheap in 1976, he thought of another way to capitalize on the situation, getting his mother, who cared nothing about money, to sell her 5,272 shares of Berkshire to Doris and Bertie. For $5,440 plus a $100,000 note, they each got 2,636 shares of Berkshire, paying the equivalent of $2 a share in cash. Buffett, who viewed debt as almost sinful, thought Berkshire was so cheap at $40 a share that he was willing to have his sisters borrow an extraordinary 95% of the purchase price to buy it. At the rate he obviously thought he could compound the stock's value, buying on these terms would make his sisters rich, and it would also avoid an enormous estate tax bill. "It's what my mother wanted to do, but it was the perfect time. That was probably the greatest move of all time. It will never happen again. That was a once-in-a-lifetime situation." Valuable properties were being sold everywhere for a pittance. Around the same time, Tom Murphy came to Warren with the chance to buy a television station. Buffett realized it would be a terrific deal, but that he couldn't buy it because it would conflict with the Washington Post Company, which also owned television stations. Since he sat on the Post board, it would put the Post over the limit the FCC allowed. "What am I involved with that I don't own?" he asked himself. He actually had to think about it to find something. Then he remembered that he didn't own Grinnell College. The first station they looked at had already sold, but at Buffett's recommendation, Grinnell bought a Dayton, Ohio station for $13 million, putting down only $2 million. Sandy Gottesman arranged debt financing for the rest. The broker who sold it to Grinnell called it the best deal he had seen in the past 20 years. There were some good reasons, however, why stocks were cheap and cities like New York were close to bankruptcy. Along with rampant inflation, out-of-control labor costs and unstable labor relations were strangling the economy. Newspapers were among the most severely affected businesses. Right after the Hilton Head meeting, on October 1, 1975, at 4 a.m., the Washington Post's union contracts expired. Some of the Post's pressmen disabled the fire extinguishers, drained the oil, stripped the gears, and ripped electrical wiring and operating machinery out of the presses. They slashed the rolls of newsprint, set fires, and left one pressroom foreman bleeding from a gaping head wound. Graham arrived within an hour to a building glaring under the lights of television cameras and engulfed with fire engines, police, and hundreds of picketers. The Post's relations with some of its unions were almost literally on a drunk, recalls Don Graham. The militant workers viewed management as incompetent, Kay was later to write, yet able enough to deviously make them scapegoats for all of the problems that could more clearly be laid at management's own door. After years of surrendering to sabotage and work slowdowns, with 9 union contracts set to expire at once, management negotiators arm wrestled with labor in an atmosphere of tension and frustration. Most of the unions, other than the pressmen, had stayed at work, especially the all-important Newspaper Guild of Journalists. Using borrowed printing plants and helicopters to move key people past picket lines, the Post started getting out an attenuated paper after only one day's disruption. But as the strike ground on, Graham became paralyzed with fears that her paper was committing suicide. The managers and scab workers could produce only half the number of papers at a quarter of their normal size, and advertisers marched steadily over to the Post's arch-rival, the Evening Star. Within days, the Star was so thick with advertising that we could hardly lift it. They called me back because they were actually afraid Kay would fall apart. We crossed the picket line together. Kay was gutsy about that. But I saw her burst into tears when she picked up the Star. The Star was trying to outpost the Post, copying their format, hiring their people. She'd wake up and call me in the middle of the night. When she felt threatened, the woman that her editor Howard Simons called the bad Catherine flew down the chimney. It wasn't really the bad Kay, it was the insecure Kay. If she got feeling insecure, she could get pretty shrill. Occasionally some incident would set her off, and then she would react like an animal. It was as if she felt nobody was on her side. She felt cornered, and nobody would quite know what to do. That's when they would call for me. Phil hadn't been on her side, and her mother hadn't been on her side. The executives at the company hadn't always been on her side. And so she always had this sense in the back of her mind that she was in an unfriendly environment, and it could be triggered by some incident. But she always knew that I was on her side. That didn't mean I agreed with her on everything, or ate everything she wanted me to eat, but I was on her side, and I always would be. The bad Catherine bore some similarities to Lila Buffett, and Warren took an obvious pride in being the one person who could win Kay's trust and keep the bad Catherine at bay. Buffett had developed so much discernment about people's motivations by now that he understood what was driving everyone around Graham and helped her gain perspective. It was a measure of what Susie had done for him that he could transmit some of her discernment to others. His antennae for people's reactions were sharp. He could help a person who felt threatened tell the difference between somebody who was actually dangerous and someone who was simply acting from fear. She thought Warren walked on water, and he did, says board member R.J. Miller. Warren was open, and she had confidence in him. For the right person, Buffett could instill an ability to see all sides non-judgmentally, an ability that Susie had instilled in him, and this marvelous gift of self-confidence and security could be internalized, so that it was not dependent on his presence. But Kay was so insecure, I don't think he ever really got her to do that, says Miller, although if anybody could have, it would have been him. She needed his actual presence. For the next 6 months, the Post would continue to publish while navigating fruitless negotiations, threats, violence, a logistical war of nerves, and a constant struggle to keep the torn newspaper guild from striking in sympathy. People were tackling all sorts of incongruous jobs to get the paper out. Don Graham worked as a paper handler, pushing huge, heavy rolls of newsprint to the presses. She had people telling her, including some of the people she respected most, "You've got to give in or you're going to lose." They were afraid. They hated not publishing and seeing the Star gain on the Post. So I was the countervailing force. I said to her, "I will tell you before the tipping point is reached. The tipping point is the point at which the other guy becomes dominant, and after you go back, he is still dominant. There are 50 variables involved. The attitude of your employees when you come back, the impression that you've left on the community, the degree to which advertising has gotten better results from having shifted over. You're gauging the likelihood of people changing their habits. They couldn't get our columnists or our comics. So the question is, at what point does it become more of a habit for them to buy the other paper? That's probably what did the most for her. She believed me, and she was right to believe me. All I had were her interests at heart, and she believed that I knew enough about the business. But while Warren encouraged her, it was her backbone, not his, stresses George Gillespie. Her backbone had to be strong enough to support the whole company. Although nearly all of the Post's employees, other than the pressmen, stayed on the job, the constant threat of violence hung over those who crossed the picket lines. Their tires were being slashed, and their families were getting threatening phone calls at home. A striker carried a placard that said, "Phil shot the wrong Graham." To keep morale up, Graham and Buffett and Mae Greenfield rolled papers in the mailroom. Buffett loved it, working circulation once again. 2 months into the strike, the Post had made a final offer to the pressmen, who rejected it. The strike dragged on, unresolved. Graham began to hire replacement workers, breaking the strike. The pressmen carried on picketing as if there was a chance of negotiation, but over the next few months, the paper gradually won back the remaining unions, readers, and advertisers, even though the picketing and bad publicity continued through the spring. Just as Graham was slowly rescuing her company, Buffett and Munger had finally reached their settlement with the SEC. Now Buffett invited Munger for a steak dinner down at Johnny's Cafe near the stockyards to finalize their simplification plan. He had decided to stop managing money for FMC on the side. Next, Blue Chip would sell its interest in Source Capital, and Berkshire and Diversified would refile their merger plan, formerly quashed at the beginning of 1975 by the SEC investigation. At Betty Peters' request, Wesco, owned only 80% by Blue Chip, would remain a public company, and Munger would be chairman of that. Munger and Buffett deferred merging Blue Chip into Berkshire Hathaway until they could more easily agree on the relative values of the companies. With both Berkshire and the Post emerging from the tumultuous times that had consumed his attention for so long, Buffett's business routine began to normalize. The Post board meetings lost their edge of emergency, and Graham began thinking of expanding her empire. Newspapers at the time were being snapped up left and right. Kay really wanted to buy newspapers, but above all, she didn't want other people to buy them instead of her, Buffett says. "Tell me what to do," she would beg. Buffett had gotten her to stop pleading for help from the rest of the board, but she still pleaded for help from him. "I would just make her make the damn decision," he says. He helped her understand that it was always a mistake to pay too much for something you wanted. Impatience was the enemy. For a long time, the Post did very little and grew slowly. Buffett taught the Grahams the immense value of buying their company's own stock when it was cheap to reduce the shares outstanding. That increased the size of each slice of the pie. Meanwhile, the Post avoided making expensive mistakes and became much more profitable as a result. Buffett, used to doing the taking, for the first time found himself in the giving role and discovered that, with Graham, he liked it. "She would talk to me about some business policy, and then she'd talk to some other guy back home, and they'd know how to scare the hell out of her. She knew they were doing it, and she didn't like it, but she couldn't get over it. Eventually, I told her my job was to get her to see herself in a regular mirror rather than a funhouse mirror. I really wanted her to feel better about what she was doing. Basically, I enjoyed trying to build her up, and I had some success, although I started late in life with her. Yet," wrote Munger to Graham about Buffett, "I can see damn well those ways, predominantly, are actually being mended." Buffett began to be seen out with Graham more and more. She made it her job to try to give him some polish. "Kay tried to upgrade me a little. It was just very gradual and not so I would notice. It was very funny. She worked so hard to sort of remold me, but it didn't work. She was a hell of a lot more sophisticated than I was, that's for sure." Buffett learned that Graham thought it was uncouth and disgusting to eat out in restaurants. Around Washington, your cook was a big point of pride. The highest compliment you could pay somebody at a party was, "I'm going to try and hire away your cook," or, "You must have brought your cook over from France." Kay cared about that, like everybody in Washington. So her dinners tended to be quite fancy, except that she would make exceptions for me. Graham's chef found the restrictions imposed by cooking for Warren a challenge. Broccoli, asparagus, and Brussels sprouts looked to me like Chinese food crawling around on a plate. Cauliflower almost makes me sick. I eat carrots reluctantly. I don't like sweet potatoes. I don't even want to be close to a rhubarb. It makes me retch. My idea of a vegetable is green beans, corn, and peas. I like spaghetti and grilled cheese sandwiches. I'll eat meatloaf, but wouldn't order it in a restaurant. His idea of a feast was a half gallon of chocolate chip ice cream. He ate his foods in sequence, one at a time, and did not like the individual foods to touch. If a stalk of broccoli brushed his steak, he recoiled in horror. I like eating the same thing over and over and over again. I could eat a ham sandwich every day for 50 days in a row for breakfast. At dinner at her farm retreat, Glen Welby, Kay served lobster. I was attacking the shellfish through the wrong side, attacking the shell, and not having much luck. She told me to turn it over. Confronted with a 9-course dinner, each course accompanied by the appropriate wines and destined for a dinner table filled with dignitaries and celebrities and journalism star reporters, it threw him, says Gladys Kaiser. He never grew accustomed to life on this grand scale. Yet Buffett became a regular guest at Graham's famous dinners, which he called her K-parties. He enjoyed his status as the hayseed who was flummoxed by a lobster. His childlike tastes conveyed an air of authenticity and innocence, but his social naivete was also genuine, mostly because he went around with blinders on. When sightseeing with Graham, he was focused like a laser on who was there, not on which fork to use. He had no desire to broaden this aspect of his horizons. Graham upgraded his elephant-bumping skills gradually, but was amazed that Buffett continued to eat nothing but hamburgers and ice cream. She always talked to the cook in French, always, totally in French, so I would hear hamburger among the French words and tease her and say, no, no, it's hamburger. Then I would just say, order me a hamburger, and it would come out of the kitchen very fancy. The chef at Kay's wanted so much to be able to make hamburgers and French fries, and I ate them, but they were not even close to as good as you could get at McDonald's or Wendy's. The French fries were always mushy, and he wanted so hard to please. But at her big parties, she didn't make exceptions for me as much. At the Kay parties, Buffett's role was not to eat, but, of course, to talk. As a star investor, he was like a bald eagle in a town where birds of any kind were scarce. Even the most hidebound of Georgetown cave dwellers, blue bloods who rarely emerged to socialize with anyone except others of their kind, many of whom were Graham's friends, such as the columnists Joe and Stuart Alsop, cousins of Eleanor Roosevelt, enjoyed having the charming Buffett around. Dinner guests pelted him with questions about investments, and he fell into his most comfortable role, the teacher. By now, he was spending so much time in Washington that he began keeping a spare set of clothes in Graham's guest room, just as he once had with the more maternal Anne Gottschalk in Long Island. Usually he wore a fraying blue suede jacket and gray flannel slacks that looked like a rumpled bedspread. Graham tried to improve his sartorial sense. She was appalled by Warren's clothes, according to her son Don, although my mother just hated the way that I dressed. And at one point, she said, referring to her employees, "Why am I, of all people, surrounded by the worst-dressed executive staff of anyone in America?" Her scorn for people's clothes was widespread and not confined to Warren. She took him to meet Halston, the Tony designer whom she preferred and who had made over her own sense of style. Buffett's take on Halston? He was from Des Moines, you know. By June 1976, Buffett had occasion to invite Graham to an event of his own, Susie Jr.'s wedding. In every way, this event would be the antithesis of a K party, held in Newport Beach, California, a mix of the formal and the casual, with a Buffettish zoo of a guest list, to celebrate a marriage that everybody knew was a mistake from the start. The spring semester of her senior year of college, Susie Jr. had dropped out of UC Irvine when her roommate learned that Century 21, a real estate company, was offering high-paying secretarial jobs that didn't require typing skills. Though they were wise enough not to interfere, both her parents knew that Susie Jr.'s marriage to Dennis Westergaard, the good-looking blonde surfer, wasn't going to work out. On some level, Susie Jr. herself knew this, but she was caught up in the fantasy. Parental reservation notwithstanding, her wedding was an important affair. Warren had asked that Kay be invited. Big Susie had reserved a special place for her at St. John's Lutheran Church, right behind the family. For a few minutes, she sat with Dick and Mary Holland, who had escorted her to the service. Then, not surprisingly, Kay said to them, "I feel uncomfortable. I don't know why, but it'd be better if I sat in back." She removed herself to the rear of the church, where she sat for the rest of the wedding. Buffett had traveled far from the day of his own wedding, when he had to take off his glasses because he was so nervous that he didn't want to see. Waiting in the rear of the church to go down the aisle, he said to his anxious daughter, "Don't look now, but my fly is open." The photographer was standing in front of the altar, waiting to snap a picture. Susie Jr. was so busy trying to stifle her laughter and to keep from looking at her father's fly so that the photographer would not capture her staring at his crotch that she forgot to be scared. The rest of the traditional ceremony proceeded without incident. Then the reception at the Newport Beach Marriott turned wild. The Buffetts had let their music groupie daughter hire any band she liked. Susie Jr. chose her favorite, Quicksilver Messenger Service, a psychedelic rock band that had been among the groups launched at San Francisco's Fillmore Auditorium in the 1960s. Its members looked like any normal rock band. As the group of 20-something men with white boy afros and nipple-length uncombed hair mounted the stage and tuned up their instruments, Buffett looked on with inner horror. When Quicksilver Messenger Service hit it with the drums and electric guitars, Susie Jr. danced in ecstasy at her rock and roll wedding, while her father managed to keep his composure, even though he was squirming inside. "I was not wild about their music," he says in an understatement. "They played awfully loud." He longed for something like his wife's sweet Doris Day style of singing, or Florence Henderson, or Sammy Davis Jr. After 90 minutes, the musicians flabbergasted him again when they stopped playing and put away their instruments. Then their manager compounded his astonishment by asking Buffett to fork over the staggering sum of $4,000 in cash. Big Susie had told her daughter, "You know, Susan, you can't go home with the band on your wedding night." "Darn," said Susie Jr., "but some of my friends did," she says. Now Susie Jr. had settled permanently in Los Angeles, working for Century 21. Howie had already dropped out of Augustana College after having trouble adjusting and connecting with his roommate. He tried a couple of other schools, but had lost his support system and never graduated. "I was so close to my mom," he says, "and everything in my life revolved around our family and our home. In college, I just could not get any traction." Neither had their father's ambition, but both had money for the first time. The trust, left by Howard to his grandchildren, had distributed a little over 600 shares of Berkshire Hathaway stock to them. Warren gave them no advice on what to do with it. He had never sold a share himself. Why would they sell theirs? Susie Jr. sold most of hers to buy a Porsche and a condo. Howie sold some of his to start Buffett Excavating. In a grown-up version of his childhood love of Tonka toys, he was now digging basements for a living. Peter, just finishing his senior year in high school, had been accepted at Stanford and would be headed to California in the fall. More and more during the summer of 1976, the house in Omaha was simply empty. Most days after school, Peter went to Arby's by himself to get something for dinner, then headed to the darkroom to work on his photography. Even the dog was decamping. Peter's friends had started calling to report, "Hamilton's over here." Big Susie, who was rarely home these days, admitted to feeling depressed about the state of her marriage. She seemed to feel that Kay was an interloper who was pursuing her husband. Kay had such a territorial way with men that it would have been surprising if Susie had felt otherwise. Yet, despite, or perhaps because of, her sadness, Susie herself was running around like a teenager, as one person put it, in the hot rush of a midlife romance. She was angry at Warren and got careless, letting herself be seen around Omaha with John McCabe, her tennis coach. She still called Milt from time to time as well, and when he agreed to see her, they too were spotted out in public. She seemed to be living in different worlds, with no plan to proceed in any direction. She could not conceive of abandoning Warren. She described him as an extraordinary man. She clearly looked up to him. However much she joked and nagged about his rigidity and his preoccupation with money, he gave her things she very much wanted: security, stability, strength. It mattered to her that he was honest and had a good value system, says Doris. If I ever let down someone who needed me, Susie said, that would be the biggest failure she could imagine. Susie was not a thinker. She had a natural confidence in her ability to manage complex relationships with multiple people, using her emotions as her guide. But somebody would have to be let down eventually. While Susie was off on her various unknown pursuits, and his three children were headed in their respective directions, Peter taking off for Palo Alto in his little yellow Triumph convertible, Howie driving a backhoe, gorilla costume in tow, and Susie Jr. embarking on married life with her good-looking surfer, Warren was on a journey of his own. The man of simple tastes, who thought of his life as something out of Leave It to Beaver, was now spending his time at parties on Embassy Row. Catherine Graham was dragging him into elephant territory as fast as she could. She didn't change my behavior as much as changing what I knew and saw. Everywhere she went, she was treated just like royalty. I saw a whole lot of interesting things that I wouldn't have seen in the world. I had a lot of things explained to me. I picked up a lot around her. Kay knew so damned much about everybody that she would give me insights on people in the political arena. It bothered her that she thought I was teaching her all these things and she wasn't doing anything for me. She was constantly laboring in terms of trying to think of something she could do to help me out, whether it was inviting me to fancy dinners or something else. You could call all these events glamorous or exotic. I found them quite interesting. I'm not knocking these things. There were probably people who were way more dying to do them, particularly in her presence, than I would be. But I had a good time doing it, you know? There undoubtedly were people who were way more dying to go. Nevertheless, Buffett did go, over and over again, no matter how ridiculous or awkward for him the events turned out to be. One night, Graham took him to a black-tie state dinner at the Iranian embassy. She wore a golden gown to match the embassy's decor. Reza Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran, was an important U.S. strategic ally and a charming host. His embassy sat at the apex of the Embassy Row, Washington social scene, and its doings glittered with a fin de siècle magnificence. After the cocktail hour, Buffett sat down at his assigned table and found himself between one of Empress Farah Pahlavi's ladies-in-waiting and Illinois Senator Charles Percy's wife. He turned toward Lorraine Percy and found her locked in a tête-à-tête with her other dinner partner, Paul Newman. Seeing that it might be a while before she turned toward him, Buffett revolved toward his right and said something to the Empress's lady-in-waiting. She smiled politely. He said something else. She smiled again, then went blank. Ted Kennedy, seated on her other side, leaned over and uttered some bon mot in French. Her face brightened, and they began conversing animatedly in French. Buffett sat stranded in the middle. He turned back to Lorraine Percy and found that she was still engrossed in Paul Newman. He realized with a dull feeling that with Paul Newman sitting on her left, it might become a very long evening. Kay had been seated next to the Shah at another table. Among these circles, she was the most important, and Warren the least important guest there. Kay was the queen, and he was some hayseed investor from Nebraska whom Kay had towed along. Forget super money, this was old money. After a while, Ted Kennedy noticed his plight and asked, "Don't you speak any French?" Buffett felt like a poseur. He had landed in Bora Bora with only a snowsuit to wear. The meal went on until 1 o'clock in the morning, and then the band began to play. To begin the dancing, one of the gentlemen waltzed the Empress around the floor. Buffett grabbed Graham's hand and escaped. And yet, if she had asked him again, he would have gone. Because he was for sure not knocking it. The sightseeing was too good. As he knew all too well by now, despite the fame from Supermoney and the articles in Forbes, many prominent people had never heard of him. In May 1976, Buffett was visiting Kay Graham in Washington when she said, "I have someone I want you to meet." Jack Byrne, the person in question, was reluctant, however. When Graham called to arrange a meeting, he said, "Who's Buffett?" "Well, he's a friend of mine," Graham said. "He's just bought a piece of the Washington Post." Neither knowing nor caring, Byrne turned down the meeting. Then Buffett's old friend Lorimer Davy Davidson, who had retired from Geico in 1970, called Byrne. "God, what kind of ninny are you to pass up a meeting with Warren Buffett?" he asked. Byrne had been hired in 1976 to try to pull Geico, on the brink of bankruptcy, out of the ditch. Once an insurer only of government employees, Geico had taken on John Q. Public. "Millions more qualified," was the tagline. "Growth, growth, growth. The emphasis was all growth," says a longtime executive. Fueled by growth, 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 Geico stock had traded as high as $61, far too rich for Buffett, but he had kept an eye on it anyway. In fact, he had never stopped following it for the past 20 years. In 1975, "I looked again at Geico and was startled by what I saw after a few rule-of-thumb calculations about loss reserves." As an auto insurance company grows, 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 so does the number of accidents its customers have. If a company underestimates the payments for those claims, it has overstated profits by the same amount. It was clear in a 60-second examination that the company was far under-reserved and the situation was getting worse. I went in to see the CEO, Norm Gidden, on one of my Washington Post trips. I had known and liked Norm for 20 years on a casual basis. He was friendly, but he had no interest at all in listening to my comments. They were in deep denial. He really sort of hustled me out of the office and would not respond on the subject. That Buffett, who did not own the stock, was trying to help Geico's management says something about how attached he still was to the company from which Lorimer Davidson had recently retired, the stock that had been his first really big idea, the investment that had made so much money for his friends and family. In early 1976, Geico announced its worst year in history, a $190 million loss from underwriting operations during 1975. The company stopped paying dividends, a move that conveys to shareholders that the till is empty. Gidden cast about frantically to bolster the mere $25 million in capital that Geico had in its coffers. That April, at Washington's Statler Hilton, 400 angry stockholders stormed the shareholder meeting, armed with questions and accusations. Shortly afterward, the insurance commissioners arrived in a squadron at Geico's offices. The board realized, a bit belatedly, that it had to fire the management. The board itself was in disarray, several of its members having lost their personal fortunes in the debacle. Without a capable CEO to steer the company, Sam Butler, a steady-handed lawyer from Cravath, Swain, and Moore, took charge as the lead board member, in effect a temporary CEO. Butler knew that Byrne had quit Travelers on impulse, bitter at having just been passed over for the job of CEO. A former actuary who became a millionaire at age 29 through a startup insurance company, Byrne had been instrumental in turning around the Travelers' flailing home and auto insurance lines 2 years earlier. Butler called him in Hartford and played on his ego, explaining that if he took the job at Geico, it would prevent a national emergency that would throw the whole United States economy into jeopardy. The unemployed Byrne was easily recruited to audition for CEO. He came down to Washington in early May and pogo-sticked back and forth before the board, tearing through white flip chart pages, covering them with marker pen while talking non-stop. "I came in and gave a sort of off-the-cuff, five-hour, blah, 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 here's 5 points, here's what we have to do, boom, boom, boom speech," he says. The desperate board had no trouble deciding that this ruddy, round-faced cannonball was the right guy. Burns' first task when he took over as CEO was to run straight to the dusty Chinatown offices of the District of Columbia's insurance superintendent, Max Wallach. An old-school German who spoke with a thick accent, Wallach was stubborn as hell, and he had this enormous interest in serving the public, Byrne recalls. He was disgusted with GEICO's former management and had refused to deal with them. Byrne perceived that Wallach was not wild about him either. Nevertheless, the two men began talking daily, sometimes hourly. Wallach insisted that the company put a deal in place by late June to raise money while simultaneously getting other insurance companies to take over some of its policies, that is, to reinsure GEICO. The idea was to increase the resources GEICO had available to pay claims and to cut the risk it was carrying so that they were more in balance. Thus, Byrne had to sell other insurers on the idea of putting up money to save a competitor. Byrne's prior experience was that he could sell anything. At first, he was confident. "My pitch was that insurance companies take care of themselves," says Byrne. "We don't want the regulators involved." If GEICO failed, the regulators would just send the bill for GEICO's unpaid claims to its competitors, so they would end up bailing it out anyway. But Ed Rust, Sr., who ran State Farm, says Byrne, he was a coony old bastard. He concluded, and he was probably pretty smart, "I'll pay $100 million to cover any of their unpaid claims if it puts GEICO out of business. They have a better mousetrap, and killing GEICO will save us money in the long run." So State Farm backed out of the reinsurance deal. In the end, says Byrne, a couple of really good friends reneged. The Travelers just said, "We're not going to help." They didn't have any principled idea behind this. Travelers was just wussy about it. 3 weeks after he joined GEICO, "I was racing around, thinking I had made the biggest mistake of my life. My wife, Dorothy, was up in Hartford, crying and crying and crying. We had just moved for the 19th time." The market was suggesting GEICO might not survive. Its stock, so recently trading for $61 a share, had crashed to $2 a share. Somebody who owned, say, 25,000 shares had just seen their fortune dwindle by almost 97%, from more than $1.5 million to $50,000, from enough to live on for the rest of your life to enough to buy a very good sports car. The reaction of the company's investors and shareholders to the calamity would, in not a few cases, literally determine their fate. Many longtime shareholders had panicked and talked themselves into selling, which is how the stock got to $2 in the first place. Whoever was buying from them took a gamble on GEICO's fate. Ben Graham, now age 82, did nothing and kept his stock. Graham's cousin Rhoda and her husband Bernie Sarnett talked to the dean of the University of Chicago Business School. He told them to sell it, since stocks that cheap rarely recover. They decided, au contraire, that a stock that had sunk so low was too cheap to sell. What would they gain by selling? They had little to lose by keeping it, so they did nothing. Likewise, Lorimer Davidson never sold a share. Leo Goodwin Jr., the son of GEICO's founder, sold and destituted himself. Shortly thereafter, his son, Leo Goodwin III, died of a drug overdose, a presumed suicide. Buffett did not own the stock, but with GEICO trading at $2 a share, he had sniffed out another situation like American Express. Here, however, the company didn't have a franchise strong enough to pull it out of the ditch. GEICO needed a tow truck. Buffett felt that only a brilliant, energetic manager had any chance of turning the situation around. He wanted to meet Byrne and size him up before committing any money to the stock. He had Catherine Graham call Byrne. After overcoming Byrne's initial resistance, she set up the meeting. Buffett waited at Graham's Georgetown house after a post-board dinner for Byrne to arrive. "This is risky," he told Don Graham. "It could go completely out of business. But in insurance, it's very hard to get an edge, and they have an edge. If they got the right person in to run it, I think he could turn it around." In came Byrne, red-faced, effervescent, 43 years old, like a firecracker exploding. The two men sat down by the fireplace in Graham's high-ceilinged library. Buffett questioned Byrne for a couple of hours. Of all the Irish-Americans who would ever swing through Buffett's orbit, Byrne had the greatest gift of blarney, and, by a wide margin, Buffett says. I was excited and babbling on and on and on, says Byrne. Warren asked a lot of questions about how I thought we were going to stay out of insolvency and what my plans would be after that. For Buffett, the question was whether Byrne really was cool, unflappable, and professional, or whether he just didn't know what was going on. He decided that Byrne understood insurance very well and had the analytical abilities, and he was a leader and a promoter. GEICO needed an analytical leader to figure out how to solve its problem, and it needed a promoter to make that sale to all the constituencies that were involved. The next morning, Buffett met up with George Gillespie, the lawyer who had sold him the Post stock, because the two men were on the board of Pinkerton's, the detective company, and there was a board meeting that day. George, he said, it's pretty uncharacteristic of me, but today I bought some stock that really might be worthless tomorrow. He had just called Bill Scott back in the office and placed an order for 500,000 shares of GEICO for Berkshire, leaving another order to buy millions more as stock became available. Scott put together a huge block trade, buying $4 million worth of GEICO for him. Buffett had waited years for the chance to buy GEICO at the right price. The tow truck had arrived, but GEICO still did not have reinsurance. It needed capital, and both depended on the goodwill of Max Wallach, the regulator. But now a new phenomenon took hold. Buffett's margin of safety was his mere presence as an investor. Having Buffett as a backer, a now legendary investor whose company already owned a successful insurer, gave Byrne a powerful card to play with the regulators. In addition, General McDermott, the head of USAA, wrote a letter to other insurers, says Byrne. The United States Automobile Association sold insurance only to military officers and behaved accordingly. Within the insurance industry, it was fabled. General Robert McDermott, almost revered. He supposedly wrote that, in the military, we never leave people behind. We have a fallen eagle here. Buffett went to see Wallach to do what he could to convince the crusty old public servant to ease up on the June deadline. But assembling the reinsurance deal was like convincing 24 shivering children to hold hands and jump into a lake. To pull it off, the story Byrne was selling was that the worthless former management, the Fowlers of GEICO, had been tossed out, that what was left of the termite-riddled house was now clean, that the seasoned Jack Byrne, rescuer of travelers, had helicoptered in to restore the damage, and so confident was the infallible Warren Buffett in Jack Byrne that he had plunked down a whopping $4 million on the stock. Nonetheless, when Byrne started hitting the banks on Wall Street, people were walking out in the middle of lunch, he says. I got kicked out of everywhere. Then Sam Butler took him down to Solomon Incorporated, an old, respected specialist bond house. Solomon had never done an equity deal, but craved to enter the lucrative business of underwriting stocks. John Gutfreund, an influential Solomon executive, sent a junior research analyst, Michael Franquelli, and his sidekick, Joe Barone, to Washington to check GEICO out. I kept them waiting for an hour and a half, so they were furious, says Byrne. But I talked till the sun came up, and they were very blank-faced. But on the way to the airport, the company driver heard them talking, and he told me they were very, very enthused on the way back. The insurance industry can't afford to let these guys go down, Franquelli told Gutfreund. It would be a terrible black eye on the industry, and these assholes will not tolerate that. But when Byrne and Butler arrived at Solomon's offices for his last-ditch attempt to raise the money, Gutfreund opened with a bruising remark. I don't know who'd ever buy that fucking reinsurance treaty you're trying to sell. You don't know any fucking thing you're talking about, said Byrne right back. Displays of testosterone out of the way, Byrne made a passionate speech, citing God and the national interest among reasons why Solomon should raise the money and referring to Buffett's investment. As Byrne waxed about GEICO's prospects and approached a liftoff, Gutfreund fiddled with a long, expensive cigar. Finally, wrung out and crestfallen, Byrne ground to a halt. Then Butler said his piece. Byrne thought, from Gutfrin's demeanor, that they had failed. Then Gutfrin pointed at Byrne and said to Butler, "I will do this underwriting. I feel you've got the right guy, but you've got to keep him quiet." Solomon agreed to underwrite a $76 million convertible stock offering by itself. No other investment bank would participate and share the risk. GEICO had to consent to an SEC decree in which it neither admitted nor denied the SEC's conclusion that it had failed to disclose its losses to the shareholders, the mere description of which in a public offering prospectus would tend to poison the deal. To get the financing done, Solomon had to convince investors that GEICO would survive, yet the financing was what would enable GEICO to survive. The deal reeked of desperation, and investors could smell it. GEICO was getting such bad press, Byrne said, that if he had walked across the Potomac River, the headlines would have screamed, "Byrne can't swim." Buffett, the ace in the hole, was unperturbed by these events. When the offering looked as if it was not going to go off, he simply went to New York and met with Gutfrin, saying he stood ready to buy the whole deal, at a price. Having a backup buyer strengthened Solomon's hand, but Gutfrin also got the impression that Buffett wouldn't mind if the deal failed, and he ended up buying all the stock. For Buffett, this was the ultimate no-risk deal. Naturally, the backup price he insisted on was low. Solomon told Byrne unequivocally that, given Buffett's ceiling, the convertible offering would sell no higher than $9.20 per share, not $10.50 as Byrne wanted. Buffett wanted as much of the stock as could be had. He asked Solomon to buy all that was available for him once the stock started trading. Buffett's willingness to buy after the offering bolstered Solomon's ability to market the deal. Otherwise, Solomon would have had to jam the stock down its customers' throats. Indeed, once the self-fulfilling prophecy of the Sage of Omaha took hold, there was more demand for the stock than shares to be had. Buffett got only a quarter of the deal. Within a few weeks, after a total of 27 reinsurers came forward to provide the required reinsurance, the common stock had quadrupled and was trading around $8 a share. And GEICO's savior, John Gutfrin, became one of a tiny handful of modern Wall Street figures whom Buffett genuinely admired. But GEICO was still not fixed. Byrne needed a 35% rate increase in New York, and speedily got it. In New Jersey, Byrne went to the decaying old capital of Trenton to plead with Commissioner James Sheeran, a handsome ex-Marine who prided himself on being tough. Byrne marched into the commissioner's office with a copy of the company's license in his pocket and told Sheeran that GEICO must have a rate increase. He had a sour-ass, little wizened actuary at his side who had been fired by some insurance company and had a bone to pick, says Byrne. Sheeran said his numbers didn't justify a rate increase. I did all the arm-waving and stuff that I could, and Mr. Sheeran was intractable. Byrne pulled the license out of his pocket and threw it on Sheeran's desk, saying, "I have no choice but to turn in the license," or something to that effect, but containing more four-letter words. He then drove back to the office with tires screeching, sent out telegrams to 30,000 policyholders canceling their insurance, and fired 2,000 New Jersey employees in a single afternoon, before Sheeran could go to court and get an injunction to stop him. "It showed everybody, all audiences, I was serious about this," recalls Byrne, "and that I was going to fight for the life of this company no matter what, including walking out of a state, which wasn't done back then." Byrne's impalement of New Jersey had exactly that effect. Everybody knew he was serious. It was like he had trained all his life for that position. It was like he'd been genetically designed for that particular period of time. If you'd searched the country, you could not have found a better battlefield commander. He had to assemble a team of people. He had to chop thousands of heads, and he had to change the thinking of those heads that stayed around. It was a Herculean job. Nobody could have done it better than Jack. He was a tough, disciplined thinker about pricing and reserves, and he demanded rational business principles and actions. Everybody knew exactly what GEICO was all about, and he worked extraordinary hours focused on a single objective. He was always interested in what made sense rather than what had been done in the past. Byrne walked through Geico's door each morning, sailed his hat 50 feet up to the upper floor of the atrium, and hollered hello to the secretaries.
"If I don't whistle by the graveyard, who is going to?" he asked. "If I don't dance, who's going to dance?"
He had a way of making people feel terrific about the place they went to work every morning, despite the career-threatening status of their employer. He chopped 40% of the company's customers, sold half of its profitable life insurance affiliate to raise cash, and withdrew from all but 7 states plus the District of Columbia. Byrne seemed to run on rocket fuel. He called his executives into meetings at the Sheraton and Westin hotels near Dulles Airport and questioned them for 15 hours at a stretch, sometimes for days at a time. He interrupted Geico's human resources manager at the podium during a meeting by saying, "You're out," and named his successor from the audience that very moment. His attitude was, "You're not running a public library here. You're trying to save a company." "Jack was unmerciful on me," says Tony Nicely, who had worked for Geico since he was 18 years old. "He liked picking on young, aggressive people, but he taught me a lot, and I will always be indebted to him. He taught me to think of the business as a whole, not separate functions like underwriting or investing. I learned the importance of a disciplined balance sheet." Byrne told his workers if they couldn't meet a certain sales figure, they would have to hoist his 240 pounds on their shoulders into a sedan chair like a Roman emperor and bear him into company meetings for a year. They made the numbers. "Wearing a huge chef's hat and a giant shamrock, I cooked Irish dinners for them," he says. "Culcannon, which is turnips and potatoes and sour milk. It tastes terrible. I'd have these big kettles and I'd pound these turnips saying, 'Oh, this is going to be wonderful.'" Buffett grabbed Byrne and his wife, Dorothy, and immediately pulled them into his circle of friends. Now, between Geico, Washington Post meetings, Pinkerton's board meetings, West Coast trips for Blue Chip and Wesco, business trips to New York, board meetings for Munsingware, a board that he had joined in 1974, and K parties, he was traveling much of the time. Buffett decided that he needed help in the office. Pushed by Big Susie, one of her tennis friends approached Warren about a job as a sort of general apprentice. Dan Grossman, a bright Yale graduate with a Stanford business degree, even offered to work for free. Buffett didn't take him up on that, but latched on to Grossman with his usual intensity. Some thought that since neither of his sons wanted to work in the business, he saw in Grossman the chance at a surrogate son, someone who could potentially succeed him. Buffett remodeled the office in order to install Grossman next door to himself. Gladys ran interference while Buffett spent hour after hour with him, explaining float, reviewing financial models of insurance companies, outlining regulatory filings, telling Grossman his stories, and leafing through the old Moody's manuals. He played hours of tennis and handball with Grossman and added him to the Graham Group, where Grossman became friendly with many people. Warren had found yet another object of obsession. Chapter 41. And Then What? Omaha, 1977. Susie's friends would say that she created a separate life for herself within her marriage as a way to accommodate Warren's obsessions. As one put it, Warren's real marriage was to Berkshire Hathaway. There was no getting around that fact. However uneasily, however, their routine had worked for them. At least, that is, it worked for them until another of Buffett's obsessions, with Catherine Graham, reached the point that it began to push Susie off stage. That was when she finally took action. Warren now spent much of his time elephant bumping at black tie events in New York and Washington with Graham, or staying at her house for her K parties. Despite his residual awkwardness and cackling laugh, he was meeting a circle of powerful, celebrated friends and acquaintances of Kay's that opened his eyes to a new world. "I met Truman Capote," he says about the author of Breakfast at Tiffany's and In Cold Blood, who had thrown the legendary black-and-white ball in Graham's honor at the Plaza Hotel in New York. The event became known as the Party of the Century.
Capote had been a confidant of many rich International Society women. He would come down to her place and sit there, this little guy all kind of hunched down on the sofa, talking in this voice you couldn't believe. But he knew all the secrets of all of them. He really did know them, because they all talked to him. He was terribly canny. The one person he really liked was Kay. Unlike the rest, he just didn't feel she was a phony, I think. Buffett had even been summoned by former British Ambassador Walter Annenberg, who owned Triangle Publications, which held, among other lucrative properties, the Philadelphia Inquirer and Buffett's childhood favorite, the Daily Racing Form. Walter read about me in the Wall Street Journal in 1977. I got this letter that read, "Dear Mr. Buffett," and he invited me to Sunnylands, his California estate. Having heard stories about the famously thin-skinned ambassador from Tom Murphy as well as from Kay Graham, who had reason to know about how easily offended he was, Buffett was intrigued. Annenberg's father featured in many of the stories. Besides the publishing interests that he had bequeathed to his son, Moe Annenberg had also left him a legacy of scandal and shame, having gone to prison for tax evasion in connection with a racing wire he ran that telegraphed horse race results to bookies all over the country. Of dubious legality, it was linked to organized crime and added to his reputation for having mobster connections. Reportedly to save his son from prosecution along with him, Moe Annenberg copped a plea and was led into jail wearing a Homburg hat and chains. Walter was later to say that his gaunt, pain-racked father, dying of a brain tumor in St. Mary's Hospital, whispered as his last few words, "My suffering is all for the purpose of making a man out of you." Whether this scene was real or imagined, Walter would later act as though he believed it. Consumed by a drive to redeem his family's honor, Walter was now responsible for the support of his mother and his sisters. He learned the publishing business through trial by fire and proved a gifted entrepreneur. He dreamed up 17 Magazine, then a booklet-sized magazine called TV Guide, a brilliant conception that fed the public's appetite for information about television schedules, shows, and stars. By the time he met Buffett, he had not only become a great business success story, but had reached the pinnacle of social respectability after Richard Nixon appointed him ambassador to England's Court of St. James. Yet even though he restored the family name, he never overcame the personal scars of his legacy. Buffett arrived at Sunnylands filled with curiosity to meet Annenberg. The two already had a connection. Annenberg was the brother of A. Simon, the spoiled widow of Ben Rosner's former partner, Leo Simon, the same A. Simon whom Rosner had decided to screw when he had sold Associated Retailing to Buffett too cheap, because she was no longer his partner. On the one occasion that Buffett had met her, A. Simon had entertained him in her vast, art-filled apartment in New York City. Maids tiptoed back and forth carrying silver trays of cucumber sandwiches. A. explained to Buffett that her pop, Moe Annenberg, once had his goons, known as the Boys, take a few shots at Leo to improve his attitude toward Moe. You can still see the bullet holes on a building on a certain corner of Michigan Avenue in Chicago, she told Buffett. A. then asked for her son to join the Buffett partnership. Warren, envisioning bullets if he turned in a year of bad results, had tap-danced his way out of the situation. Her brother, Walter, had spent decades establishing a reputation for propriety, about as different from the image of bullets on Michigan Avenue as you could get. Sunnylands was a vast, opulent oasis in the desert in Rancho Mirage, California. Amid a garden filled with the images of Mayan sun gods, Rodin's bronze sculpture of Eve stood in a reflecting pool, covering her face in shame. Hundreds of floating bromeliads gazed up at her from the water beneath her feet. At Sunnylands, Annenberg had entertained Prince Charles, hosted Frank Sinatra's fourth wedding, and given his friend, Richard Nixon, peace and quiet to write his last State of the Union address. He had a courtly way about him and was very formal. We went outside and back by the pool, and Walter sat down. He was beautifully dressed and looked as though everything he was wearing had been bought that morning. He was about 70 at the time, and I was about 47, and he said, in a nice, kind manner, as if he were talking to a young man he was trying to help, "Mr. Buffett, the first thing you should understand is, nobody likes to be criticized." That was setting the ground rules for getting along. Nothing could be easier for Buffett. I said, "Yes, Mr. Ambassador, I've got it. Don't worry about that one." And then he started in on essentiality. "There are three properties in the world," he said, "that have the quality of essentiality. They are the Daily Racing Form, the TV Guide, and the Wall Street Journal. And I own two out of three." What he meant by essentiality was that, even during the Depression, he saw the Racing Form being sold for $2.50 down in Cuba. The Racing Form had that quality because there was no source of better or more complete information about handicapping horses. It sold 150,000 copies a day, and it had for about 50 years. It cost more than $2, and it was essential. If you were headed to the racetrack and were a serious racing handicapper, you wanted the Racing Form. He could charge whatever he wanted, and people were going to pay it. It's like selling needles to addicts, basically. So every year, Walter would go in and say, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, how much should I raise the price of the Racing Form this fall?" And the mirror would always say, "Walter, charge another quarter." This was when you could buy the entire New York Times or Washington Post for a quarter. And yet, thought Buffett, the New York Times and the Washington Post were great businesses. That meant the Daily Racing Form was an incredible business. Annenberg enjoyed owning two of the essentialities, but he wanted to own all three. The visit to Sunnylands was the beginning of a reel that he and Buffett would dance from time to time, talking about whether and how they could buy the Wall Street Journal together. But the real reason that he had me out there was to send a message to Kay. The Annenbergs and the Grahams had once been friends. Then, in 1969, during the confirmation hearing for Annenberg's appointment as ambassador to Great Britain, the Post's muckraking columnist, Drew Pearson, penned a column saying that Annenberg's fortune was built up by gang warfare, and repeated an unsubstantiated rumor that his father had paid $1 million a year in protection money to mob boss Al Capone. Annenberg, enraged, accused Graham of using her paper as a political weapon against President Nixon, the man who had restored the Annenberg family to respectability by taking the risk of nominating him for the ambassadorship. "President Nixon may have had his flaws," Annenberg said later, "but he paid me the highest honor that anyone ever paid the family." The morning of his confirmation hearing, Annenberg read another Pearson column that described at length his editorial vindictiveness at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He clutched his chest and his face turned purple. His wife thought he was having a heart attack. Annenberg called Graham to ask for a retraction. She tried to soothe his feelings, but said she never interfered with the editorial page. That evening, after a stressful day of hearings in which Walter had had to defend himself one by one against the points made in the Pearson columns, the Annenbergs reluctantly went to Graham's Georgetown mansion to attend a dinner party for 50 guests to which they had been invited many weeks before. Upon entering the gilded splendor of Graham's drawing room, Annenberg, who cared deeply about protocol and who was well primed to take offense that night, did indeed take offense when Graham seated someone else next to herself and seated him between two of her friends, Evangeline Bruce, wife of the outgoing British ambassador David Bruce, and Lorraine Cooper, the wife of a prominent senator. Annenberg's prickliness about anything he took as a slight resembled in many ways his friend Nixon's lack of perspective. He and Nixon also shared an unfortunate inability to charm and disarm. Thus, a feud that had been brewing between Mrs. Annenberg and Vangie Bruce over the decoration of the ambassadorial residence soon escalated and overshadowed the meal. Compounding this, Mrs. Cooper offended Annenberg by supposedly implying that he wasn't rich enough to be ambassador. Feeling that he had been set up, Annenberg stalked out of the party early and stopped speaking to Kay Graham. Kay was distraught about it. She wanted enormously to get along with Walter. Kay was not looking to have fights with anybody. That was not her style. She liked being in charge, but she did not like to show off. She liked big shots, and she liked big shot guys particularly. So it was not comfortable for her to be in a fight with him. But she also wanted Walter to understand that she wasn't going to tell Ben Bradley what to write about in the paper. So by the time I went out to see him, he was thinking about having a book commissioned about Phil Graham and how Phil's teeth were in a funny way. Phil Graham's teeth. Walter had a theory that if you were gap-toothed, that was a sign of mental instability. And if Walter had a theory, you didn't argue with it. Walter liked me, but one reason that he liked me was that I never disagreed. If Walter said to me, black was white, I just wouldn't say anything. So I became the go-between with Kay. Annenberg expected Buffett to deliver the message that if he published the book about Phil Graham's teeth, well, that's show business. Meanwhile, he couldn't have been nicer to me. He put me in this super fancy guest room, and he took me into his office, where he had a little display in a glass case of a Prussian coin, a pocket knife, and one other thing. It was all that his grandfather had in his pocket when he landed in this country from Prussia. And he said, "Everything you see here is a product of that." In a period of not that many years, Walter had rehabilitated his family. He did his father proud. And that was his number one goal in life, to do his father proud.